set of simple Ohm's rule, Ohm's law type of measurements. But if you look at nanosecond to nanosecond, a hell of a lot is going on, and there are times that's very important. KC2QIQ, K2RIW, go ahead, Glenn.
Yeah, very, very true, Dick. Definitely on the impulse point. But I think also the other point to be made here is even in a steady state, for a steady state of V, I, and R, there's also a steady state of magnetic field that's also surrounding that whole structure between the battery, the wires, and that resistor. And it's a magnetic field. And there is a certain amount of duality between the magnetic field that's around the outside that can be measured completely independently. So in other words, if you didn't have a current meter, a voltmeter, or an ammeter, if you had all, I mean, this would be a very difficult measurement to make, but if you knew all the full geometry of that circuit, and you could measure the field all the way around that whole thing, you could come up with an equivalent in magnetic energy as you could as with electrical energy there. K2RW, KC2QIQ.
Yeah, up till now, I've been talking about the transient that happens the instant you close the switch, current starts to flow, and for the first nanosecond, very different things happen than during the next millisecond and the next second. You've had the circuit running now for 10 minutes. At the instant you open the circuit, and you think you're disconnecting the battery, that length of wire has had current flowing through it. There's a magnetic field flowing around that wire. Even though it's only got millihenries or microhenries of inductance, there is stored magnetic energy on that wire because current was flowing through it. The wire has a certain spacing to the ground plane, this distributed capacitance of that wire. So if you're looking nanosecond per nanosecond, at the instant you open the switch, all kinds of crazy transients happen because you had stored magnetic energy, stored electrostatic or capacitive energy. Maybe it's only picofarads worth of it, but there are times when those picofarads, depending on what you're doing, are very important. So at the instant you turn it on, how long you leave it on, at the instant you turn it off, funny things happen if you want to look at the nitty-gritty. KD2SHO, K2RIW. Go ahead, John.
Okay, really, real good and real interesting, guys. I appreciate all of the comments. I will read further. Oh, and as an additional comment, when we were talking about this and going back to things like Maxwell's equations, I was surprised to see at the date that some of those original equations were made. I don't have that right in front of me at the moment, but it was something in the late 1800s. So very interesting stuff, and looking forward to digging in further and wrapping my mind around all of it more. Appreciate the comments. Appreciate the ability to check in here on the TechNet and everything you guys do. Wonderful TechNet, always enjoy it. K2RIW, KC2SHO.
Hey John, KC2WJB. Looks like we got another happy customer. We'll have to send him a bill. No, the other way around. He's making a testimonial. The check's in the mail. There was another point I was going to make, a very important point. Unfortunately, I've lost it. Too bad. Let's see now. We've gone down the list of everybody who signed in. Yes, I think we have. Boy, I wish I could think of this great closing comment I had on this particular subject. Every time you think you've got a simple circuit, it's not simple. Oh, yes, Maxwell. Maxwell wrote his equations. He was standing on the shoulders of Faraday. Faraday had done a lot of work. Ampere had done a lot of work. He was standing on their shoulders when he wrote his so-called Maxwell's equations. He did that somewhere around 1860. So James Clerk Maxwell, even though it's spelled C-L-E-R-K, it's pronounced Clerk. James Clerk Maxwell, somewhere around 1860, wrote those equations. He wrote 20 individual equations. Let me drop. The so-called Maxwell's equations, written by the author himself, 20 equations he wrote. 10 or 20 years later, Oliver Heaviside came along and said, I see a relationship between those, and he rewrote them in a more compact form, a more vector form, and he boiled them down to four distinct equations, which can be written in the integral form, the differential form, and whatever. But the 20 original equations got squeezed down to four equations. The way we teach that in our schools, though, I know it can be done a lot better, because of all the people that I've interviewed who are making application for a particular RF engineering job at a number of companies I've worked at, particularly a guy that's fresh out of school, and I ask him which of all the electrical engineering courses gave him the most amount of trouble. Roughly 50% of those engineers will say that damn fields and waves course, that Maxwell's equations course. Boy, that gave me a lot of trouble. And so in order to really use that material in a working environment where you're designing RF circuitry and antennas and transmission lines and components and whatever, it takes a hell of a lot of apprenticeship to find out how to apply what you've been taught. You can't walk out of that room with a bachelor or a master's degree whistling that tune and really use that stuff without a hell of a lot of exposure to the real world and apprenticeship. Whereas a guy taking computer science and computer engineering, he can walk out of the school and he can start designing logic circuits and he can start writing code. So there's a huge difference in the useful engineering information that's being conveyed in those two areas. For instance, let me drop. That's a bunch of opinions, but still, roughly 50% of all the engineering applicants that I have seen had strong dislike for that particular course. I've also watched in the schools that I've gone to, a significant number of electrical engineering students had so much trouble with that course, they decided they did not like electrical engineering. They dropped out and went to mechanical engineering, industrial engineering, lots of other kinds of engineering, because they thought that those RF engineers with that particular course were crazy people, and they didn't want to spend any time there. It was boring, hard to understand, and much too esoteric for them. Okay, I think it's time we go over to the mailbag. John, KC2WGB, how many responses have we had this week, and what kind of a baffling questions did you get from these scientists out there? KC2WGB with the mailbag, and what have you seen on the chat room and Echo Link tonight, John? You got it, John. K2LIW.
KC2WGB. Let's see. Echo Link is busy. We had 10 before. We're down to 9. Chat room is very quiet. There's only 2 people that have visited tonight, but that's almost normal. But Echo Link is doing really well. All right, let me drop, and I'll go on to my first question. Okay, this young gentleman is reading up on the Minerva line. He'd like you to describe its use and its application in a quick way. I know that can be quite lengthy, but maybe you could cover cable and waveguide. Back to you, Dick. KC2WGB.
If somebody handed you a great big length of Andrew Heliax, inch and 5/8 Andrew Heliax, I don't know the exact price, but it's probably something in the vicinity of $3 or $5 per foot, and somebody has just given you 200 feet of it. Very valuable piece of cable. And most of the frequencies you and I are likely to use, inch and 5/8 Andrew Heliax, as long as we can tolerate its weight and its size, it's got extremely low insertion loss and can take zillions of watts of power. Very high quality air-filled cable, one of the Cadillac products of the Andrew company. Okay, inch and 5/8 is the inside diameter of the outer conductor. And you've got a piece of RG8 cable in your hand, which has got an outside diameter of something like 4/10 of an inch. And you say to house, I can buy the connector for that cable for $50. I can buy the connector for my RG8 cable for $5. I can buy the adapter that goes between the two for another $75. I don't know the exact number, but great big numbers. You say to yourself, well, I got this cable for free. Why do I have to pay all this money just for the damn connectors and the adapter that goes between the two? I want to connect my RG8 cable directly to that inch and 5/8. As you can see, you've got a huge difference in diameters. If by way of metallic sheet, you make a tapered cone-like structure that tapers from the 1 5/8 down to your cable. With very simple metal shears and solder, you could make a tapered structure. And as long as the tapering takes place slow enough, in other words, you're changing the diameter X number of inches per wavelength, so to speak. As long as the taper is slow.
Repeater, timeout.
As long as that taper between the great big chunk of cable and let me make it more ridiculous. Let me taper it all the way down to a piece of RG58 cable, which is something like a quarter of an inch in diameter. As long as I do that taper slow enough for both the center conductor and the outer conductor, that tapered section, which might be, let me pick a number, a foot long. It'll be a little bit homely looking, and weatherproofing it'll be a little bit difficult. But now you sweep it on a good vector network analyzer. You may find out that it's got extremely good impedance of damn close to 50 ohms from DC to 1,000 megahertz. Under normal circumstances, you just slap one piece of connector, one piece of cable against the other. You strip apart the center conductor and the shield of the RG8 cable and bridge it across that gap between center conductor, which is a piece of copper tubing, by the way, to the outer conductor of your 1 5/8 inch iliac. You make that crude connection that I just described, and you'll have a whole lot of standing wave ratio at 400 megacycles and above, for instance. But you do that taper, and all of a sudden it works like a charm. So the bottom line of whether you're building an absorber for the walls of your anechoic chamber where you do antenna testing, let me drop it. Whether it's the absorptive walls of the chamber, whether it's coaxial connector adapters, whether you're doing an adapter between the twin lead and coax cable and strip line and microstrip, as long as you do the tapering slow enough in dB per wavelength or ohms per wavelength, ohms of apparent impedance versus wavelength. And you can also take a piece of magic cable that's got, you've got 300 ohm twin lead cable. And if I make a structure that slowly tapers from an impedance of 300 ohms down to 50, and I do that taper long enough, I can have it go almost DC to light and be impedance matched. The bottom line of all this is a little bit like a lobster that you put into a great big pot of water, and then you put the pot of water on the stove. And he's being slowly heated. He doesn't even know. He's getting used to it as the water is getting hot. He doesn't even know he's being cooked, if you know what I mean. RF energy is a little bit like that. If you do the taper slowly enough, it's extremely broadband. If you decided to make a dummy load for a piece of waveguide, you've got a round piece of waveguide, 3/4 inch diameter copper tubing that you bought at the Home Depot store, which makes beautiful waveguides at 10 gigahertz. Let me drop. And you want to make a perfect dummy load for it. You can go out and buy one for $500. You take a 3/4 inch diameter wooden dowel that you bought in Home Depot that barely fits on the inside of that piece of 3/4 inch copper tubing. And now, one end of that dowel, you sharpen it as if it was a pencil. And as long as you make that taper slow enough between 3/4 inch dowel down to zero, and as long as you've got a sharp enough tip at the end, and you put that thing down the piece of copper tubing, and now you apply RF energy down that thing, it'll be a nearly perfect dummy load. I have done that, and I have instrumentation that can measure what is the reflection coefficient. And the reflection coefficient was more than 30 dB down, minus 30 dB reflection coefficient. That's a medium high quality dummy load across the whole down frequency region where the 3/4 inch waveguide is a very good piece of waveguide, 3/4 inch round copper tubing. So again, it's a tapered structure. RF energy, those pyramids on the wall of an anechoic chamber are a step and repeat periodic structure. That wave hitting the wall as a flat sheet of RF energy touches the tips of a whole bunch of those pyramids simultaneously. The pyramids slowly pierce that flat sheet of the first cycle of that wave, which is a flat sheet of energy that's coming at it because you've just turned on the transmitter, and these spikes are penetrating that flat sheet, and as the flat sheet of RF energy goes deeper and deeper into those pyramids, the spikes are are penetrating further and further. It's a slow tapering characteristic. You'll notice that if your anechoic chamber goes to lower and lower frequencies, those pyramids become bigger and bigger. Let me drop it. You want those pyramids to be a slow, piercing device that hits the RF energy hitting them, slow at the wavelength you're operating at. Those pyramids have to be a foot high if you want your chamber to go down to 1 gigahertz. To make the chamber work at 10 gigahertz is easy. To make a chamber work at 1 gigahertz is starting to get hard. To go below that gets super hard. Those pyramids have to get bigger and bigger if you want the chamber to have low reflectivity at those frequencies. So the Minerva line is a way of describing. Mr. Minerva did a study of these tapered structures. You can taper between twin lead and unbalanced coaxial cable if you do the taper small enough. You can taper between 300 ohms and 50 ohms if you do it slow enough. So any kind of a slow taper, the RF energy doesn't know that you've made a change, and it'll keep going right down there and be very happy and give you very little reflection, and 99% of the energy will flow through the structure. That's part of what Mr. Minerva was saying. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet. By the way, you can read about Minerva as a referenced article that's in the Antenna Engineering Handbook, and I'm not sure which chapter, but there's a chapter of the Antenna Engineering Handbook that uses Mr. Minerva as a reference, and you go to that particular Microwave Theory and Technique article, and you'll read the specifics of what he said, which of course he said a hell of a lot better than I just did. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
KC2WGB. Very good. Yeah, that gives him a good example of what it means. And good luck reading. Yeah, and he might be able to find that on the web. I believe that book is now published on the web. I have a copy of it, as you do. And good book. A lot of information in there. All right. Let me let it drop. Oh, by the way, I'd like to know if Paul is in attendance at this time. Paul, are you out there?
Copy you, John, WS2N.
And there was a launch that took place today. Go ahead, John, with your question.
Paul, I have a question that was sent to me. I'm going to turn it over to you. You don't have to do it tonight. You may have to research it. I'm not sure. But this gentleman is asking, are there any experiments still being performed from the Apollo missions to the moon? There may be a couple, I'm not sure, but maybe you could speak about that during the space report if you have time. Just no rush. If you need time, no problem. All right, let me let it drop, and I'll go on to my next one. Okay, we got a question about waveguide beyond cutoff. All right, whether it's a Faraday cage or waveguide beyond cutoff, the gentleman would like to know, does that cause heat to develop in the waveguide because it's not leaving? What actually happens to that energy? Over to you, Dick.
If you read the right reference, I can't quote a good one right now. Yes, Southworth. Mr. Southworth's book, and John will tell me the name of the book because I keep forgetting the title of the book. Roughly around 1950 or so, I think he wrote this Don book. I think it's I even forgot the publisher's name. But Mr. Southworth wrote a very good book. You get a copy of it. It's an oldie but goodie. A lot of good stuff is in there. You take a piece of rectangular waveguide, and the RF energy goes down that waveguide even though there is no semiconductor. That RF energy going down the guide is a little bit blind. It doesn't know it's in a waveguide. It thinks it's in a barbershop. You go to your barbershop where he's got mirrors on the front wall and the back wall, and you look at those mirrors at a 45-degree angle, and you see the last barber's chair multiple times down there. You can picture yourself as a light wave bouncing back and forth between the walls of that barbershop, and if the mirrors are clean enough, the light wave doesn't even know it's in a barbershop, that it's in a closed chamber. It thinks it's in a great big piece of empty space. That wave going down the waveguide bounces back and forth across the narrow walls, opposite of common sense. It zigzags back and forth between the narrow walls. And it's a double zigzag. It's not just one zigzag. It's a double zigzag like an opened up pair of scissors. Each one of the blades of the scissors represents one of the paths of wave number one and wave number two, so to speak. There's two separate waves zigzagging down that waveguide. For each individual frequency where the waveguide is rated to work, let me drop. All of those bounces off those narrow walls come back together multiple times in phase with each other on each and every bounce. The bottom line of that is that if you're in the right frequency region for that size of waveguide, where the width between the two narrow walls must be greater than a half wavelength, for each width of waveguide and each frequency that you're using, there is an exact angle of bounce where all of this comes back together on each individual bounce, all comes back in phase. The bottom line of that is that for each and every frequency, there is an exact angle of bounce of that wave going down that line. One and only angle to the nearest micro degree is the exact angle that that signal is bouncing. By the way, because the signal is zigzagging back and forth, it takes longer for the signal to get down the waveguide than if it went straight down the middle, like your line of sight, if you know what I mean. Let me drop. Now, as you go to lower and lower frequencies, the bounce becomes a more and more drastic angle. It comes closer and closer to a perpendicular bounce. At the exact cutoff frequency, the signal is bouncing back and forth between the two narrow walls and not progressing forward at all. That's waveguide beyond cutoff. As you go to that frequency and lower frequencies, where the distance between the two vertical walls, the two narrow walls, is a half wavelength, slightly under a half wavelength in dimension, the signal bounces back and forth and doesn't progress. Now, you're putting a certain number of watts in there, it's bouncing back and forth, and it's got a little bit of loss on every bounce. Is the waveguide getting hot? Yes. Is all the energy being dissipated as heat? Yes. You put a milliwatt of energy into a piece of waveguide that's at the cutoff frequency, you'll get amount of heating of the waveguide that's exactly 1 milliwatt worth of heating. It has no other place to go. By the way, to launch that signal in the waveguide beyond cutoff, that's a very difficult launch. If you got your waveguide to coax adapter, let me drop it. You're taking the signal out of your signal generator. By way of directional couplers, you know how much forward power and reverse power is happening on the coax cable that goes into the waveguide to coax adapter. And you're now going to lower and lower frequencies so that your piece of waveguide is now approaching the cutoff frequency. The apparent impedance that you will see will start becoming very inductive. In other words, you'll start seeing a pure reactance. There appears to be no resistive component anymore. So launching the signal into the waveguide is very difficult. But of the signal you manage to launch into the waveguide, it bounces back and forth and doesn't go anywhere. And what amount of signal you manage to launch into the guide, it gets burned up as heat, because it can't progress. That gives you a little bit of a feeling what happens at waveguide beyond cutoff. But the magic of waveguide beyond cutoff is it's got a ridiculous amount of loss per foot. Let me drop. One of the very nicely, highly calibrated output attenuators is the one that's the piston attenuator that's on a Hewlett-Packard 608 signal generator. That piston attenuator, which works between 10 megs and 460 megahertz, has an extremely well-calibrated dB per distance. That attenuator goes up to 120 dB of loss. The piston attenuator, I've seen it physically. As I remember, it's around 10 inches long. So 10 inches long has 120 dB of loss. That's a lot of dB per inch, if you know what I mean. You get a huge amount of loss per inch in waveguide beyond cutoff, and it is extremely well-calibrated loss. In other words, the signal goes down there a little bit of the signal leaks, but it's extremely lossy. And it's a very well-calibrated insertion loss. Therefore, if you take a piece of waveguide that's capable of operating down to 1 gigahertz as the lowest possible frequency, let me drop. And if you take this piece of waveguide and you're about to use it at 500 megahertz, when it's waveguide beyond cutoff at 1,000 megs and below, and you're using it at 500 megs. And you build a launching structure at the input end of the guide, and there is a receiving structure at the output end of the guide, and the piece of guide is, let me pick a number, 10 inches long. The loss between those two launchers and receivers is going to be 120 dB. Now you start putting inside of that waveguide fins and probes. In other words, you've got a screw coming in from the wall, from one broad wall toward the other wall, and you're adding extra capacitance. So you put various structures inside of that piece of waveguide, and if you put the right kind of structure in there, you can design a beautiful bandpass filter. It's called an evanescent filter. The basic structure from input end to output end is extremely well shielded, and only the resonant structures you put inside of the guide give you the exact frequency of resonance and the exact frequency that the signal will propagate down there. Evanescent waveguide filter type techniques. There's a whole science of doing that. You go to the classic book on the subject called Mattai, Young, and Jones. Mattai, Young, and Jones is a real fat McGraw-Hill book that will show you a whole lot of these waveguide-like filter structures. They work extremely well. Well-designed filter like that can have brick wall skirts to it, beautiful flat bandpass, very low insertion loss, and an extremely good filter where the actual raw material that goes into the filter, let me drop it. Well, the raw materials in the filter are very inexpensive. The performance is extremely high. I will warn you that the theory of evaporation is pretty dense stuff, but you go to the right references, and somebody will say that you take this piece of waveguide, you add this screw length and that piece of web length and whatever, you physically produce this inexpensive stuff inside of that piece of waveguide, and you'll get this very high quality filter. So there are designs out there, you just copy it, you make an exact Chinese copy, and you'll get a very high performance filter. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the Tech Man.
Here's DPZ with a comment.
Go ahead, Hal.
Thank you, Dick. You know, when you mentioned waveguide off attenuators, I was just thinking back many years ago. I was doing work on UHF frequencies, and I really couldn't afford a UHF signal generator at the time. And measurements made, it was called a measurements model 80, which went from 2 to 400 megahertz. Well, I had to go up like 450, 460. And what I did, I used a 220 frequency and used a second harmonic. And when I scratched the point on the attenuator for the waveguide, the little cutoff attenuator, I had a beautiful signal generator to align receivers. It was highly accurate. Go ahead, Dick.
Yeah, that beautiful Boonton. Boonton was one of the brand names, I think, of what you're referring to as the Model 80 signal generator, a classic. And I think that is a Canadian design, isn't it, Hal? Go ahead.
I'm not Dick. I know one thing. It uses 955 oscillators and a shielded, double shielded case as far as the oscillator section. Waveguide below cutoff attenuator. It went from 2 to 400 megahertz. And you had a 1 meter sort of modulation for AM. But if you turn the modulation way down, it had this residual FM that was great for aligning the receivers in the 60s.
Yeah, this is a non-synthesized, free-running oscillator, signal generator, 855 Acorn tube is the actual active device in there. And I believe it takes a good half hour to warm up before it stops drifting. The amount of drift it has could walk you out of a 450 receiver pretty fast if you didn't allow it to warm up. Isn't that roughly true, Hal? K6DPZ, K2RIW?
Right, Dick. I had the thing warm up for about 5-6 hours. But obviously I had some stability to it, some UHF equipment up. But, you know, at the time, you know, in the 60s when I had the business, I only had so much to work with, and I had, you know, work I had to repair and starting out UHF equipment. So with that type of a generator and an old Gertz frequency meter and a deviation meter, some piece of surplus, I may do, if you know what I mean.
As old as that thing is, I bet you that's a 1945 design. That Boonton Model 80 or Measurements Model 80 and the Hewlett-Packard 608 signal generator. Oldies but goodies. I'll bet you they still appear periodically on the surplus market, or I'll bet you they appear on eBay, and I bet you get a lot of your money out of one of those these days. What do you think, Hal? K6TPZ, KQRIW.
KQRIW, K6TPZ. Funny you used to mention that. Some of the repair shops in South America and some of the other places where they don't have a lot of money, those things get shipped out to them, and they're very happy to have that type of equipment to work on the VHF and UHF radio equipment.
One of the favorite signal generators that you and I have fallen in love with is that Hewlett-Packard. I'm having trouble remembering the model number right now. It's got a free-running cavity oscillator with a countdown circuit, very accurate signal generator, and it is a freak lock loop. It's got a built-in frequency counter. When you put it in the freak lock mode, it gives you a very highly stabilized signal generator. I bet you you've had 50 of those flow through your hands over the last 10 years. What's the model number on that thing there, John? The one that you and I have fallen in love with. K6TPZ, K2LIW.
8640B. That's the one. It had some options. There's an option on the 8640B, reverse power protection module. Also a doubler, which took you from 540 megahertz up to 1080. Also, there was a variable oscillator that you could plug in as a module in place of the just one tone oscillator. Phenomenal generator. It uses a cavity oscillator up between 400 and 500 megahertz. They divide down and filter, and your signal is one of the purest generators around as far as phase noise.
And on the surplus market today, I think you can buy one of those in rather good shape for, I'm going to make a guess, approximately $300. Hal, what do you think? K2LIW?
It's got one reverse power module and everything. You're working. You may find something on eBay that doesn't work. But figure you're going to spend anywhere from $900 to $1,200 for an 8640B.
About 5 years ago, I bought a pair of them for the project that I was on. And I paid about half that, and they were in good working condition. Yeah, they needed a little bit of service, but there's a lot of quality in that signal generator. Okay, John, time to go on to the next one. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet. You got it, John.
K2HUH.
Mr. HUH, go right ahead.
Alrighty, all, thank you for picking me up. I just wanted to mention to the net that I repaired the MFJ tuner. I had to repair it and align it. It now reads exactly what the radio reads on dummy load, coax direct, and to the antenna. So obviously, it is on the input. Knowing that made me want to repair it and align it. Although I would prefer if it was on the output, because then I can use the radio and the output of the tuner. But they both coincide now exactly, like 99%. So I'm finished with that. To HOH. Send him a bill too.
Congratulations, Andy. Okay, you did some good work, but now you're holding us in suspense. You've corrected the problem. You've made the repair, you said, but you didn't tell us what you repaired. What was the error in 2HUH, K2RW? You got it, Andy?
Partially, you have to leave it up to your imagination, but there was a cold-sided joint on the board that houses the circuitry for the sensing circuit. So Richie actually gave me that idea. Then almost all the input on the net just made me want to check everything. Actually, I found loose grounds on the coax feeds on the tuner. So let me make sure I don't forget anything. I actually resoldered what I had to resolder without checking to see what did what. I just did basically the best realignment and how would you call it, overhaul on it. You know, anything loose, anything that doesn't look like a bright sided joint, but definitely some cold sided joints. And the screws were loose to the connectors in the back, so I tightened everything. Then I noticed that it was still out of alignment, so I aligned it, and now I have 3 meters that coincide. I have a Motorola meter, the radio. Let me let it drop. The Motorola meter, the MFJ tuner meter, and the radio meter all coincide. And basically, now that's why they call it mostly fun junk, because you actually have to go over everything that they do inside the unit. But it's working perfect. N2HUH.
Congratulations, Andy. Sounds like it was worth the effort. You now have the best high-quality calibrated MFJ 989 Bravo that Richmond Hill, Long Island has ever seen. The best one with all its shining glory is sitting there in Richmond Hill running like a charm. Well done, Andy. John, go over to your next mailbag item. And KC2WGB, KQRIW in the TechNet.
Okay, Dick. First of all, that book you were referring to, for the people who might be interested, by Southworth, is called Principles and Applications of Waveguide Transmission by Van Nordstrom. And good book. I've enjoyed it and trying to understand some of it. All it does is bring up more questions, but for anybody who's interested, excellent material. All right, let me let it drop. I'll go on to my next one. All right, the last one. This young amateur is working with a meter. It's a DC volt meter. And his question is, he can't get it to zero. Now, there's that little screw on the bezel that he turns, and it does work. It goes back and forth, but he can't get it to zero. It stops. So he took it apart, and he snapped the plastic cover off the front, and there are terminating pins that limit the needle to keep it from turning around like a motor. There's one on the right and one on the left. So he wants to know, that one seems to be bent. If he straightens that out or bends it back to where he can get to zero, will that affect the accuracy of the meter? What do you think about that, Dick? KC2WGB.
26DPZ.
Okay, Hal. Hal, you're going to have to back off on the audio. You're putting out square waves and you're jumping out of the machine 50% of the time. But you've been there with Dawson valve movements, so give him the information. K6DPZ, K2RIW.
K2RIW, K6DPZ. He could move that little stop, but I suggest he uses a toothpick that's non-metallic. If you use anything else that's metallic, you can pull right into the magnet and damage the meter. A little toothpick, he can very easily gently move the stop over so he has enough travel on the zero adjustment in the front of the meter. It will not affect the calibration. That's my quickie answer, Dick.
A good answer, Hal. And there's a couple other things you've got to be very careful when you open up the cabinet, the front panel, or whatever, of a Dawson valve movement, a meter. How many degrees the needle moves versus how strong a current you put into it is determined primarily by how strong is the magnet and how many turns are on that coil of wire that's connected to the needle. And you're not changing the number of turns, you're not changing the strength of the magnetic field, so you're not really affecting the calibration. However, when you open up that case, make sure you're in an extremely clean environment. The strength of that magnet, when it's open to the outside air, it will find every single little piece of steel wool or any other metallic object that your eye, that's too small for your eye to see. That magnet will find every one of those particles. And if one of those particles decides to put itself inside of the jaws of that magnet, and it sits itself between the magnet and the coil that's moving, you'll now have a very sticky meter. And to remove that piece of garbage, that metallic chunk of microscopic stuff that's in there is extremely difficult. Make sure you've got a clean environment, because it's like doing eye surgery or brain surgery, and you open that case. Be very careful with it. That's part of the reason Hal is telling you with no uncertain terms, be sure you use a toothpick or a wooden stick. Don't use a metallic tool. You bring a metallic tool near that magnet, it may suddenly get sucked in. It may suddenly put a huge amount of pressure against that coil and can easily do damage. So these Dawson valve movements are beautiful things, but you got to treat them with tender, loving care. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
KC2WGB, oh, absolutely true. Every piece of dust, everything. I had to take one apart recently to replace one of the jewels that cracked, and it was causing the meter to stick, and that was a little bit of a project, but it went well. All right, Dick, that's it from the mailbag, so let's go over to Paul and see what news he's got for us. KC2WGB, back to you, Dick.
I think there was a very successful launch today, Paul, and I think the previous attempt at this kind of a launch was a couple of years ago with a launch failure in between and thousands of dollars worth of, hundreds of thousands, if not millions of dollars worth of hardware went up in smoke. So bring us up to speed on all this, Paul. WS2N with the Space Report, K2RIW in the TechNet.
And, yeah, what you're talking about, the spacecraft actually went up last Monday, but it was docked to the International Space Station today. So, yeah, it's been up there for about a week or so. This was the one that was... that we were able to see from Long Island. It went off at nighttime. It was supposed to go off at 7:40, and it went off at 7:45, about 5 minutes late. They just wanted to check a couple of things. They had a 5-minute window, and they waited to the end of that window. And that was the one launch from Wallops Island. And it was, yeah, it's been a rocket that was supposed to go off a while back, and delayed a couple of times, but now it got off the ground. It's using new engines, the RD-181s, and it had over 5,000 pounds of cargo to the space station. Before I go on, is this the launch you're thinking about, Dick, or was there another one I missed?
That's the one I'm talking about, Paul.
Okay, understood, yes. Orbital ATK launched that. And on board was plenty of equipment and things for the space station crew. When it was launched, there was 3 people on board. But by the time it docked, there was 6 people on board. And that's why they waited. It went off on Monday. Could have gotten there 2 days later, but they decided to keep it in orbit for almost a week, because they had a launch on the 19th of 3 people from Baikonur, Kazakhstan. You know, they launched the Soyuz spacecraft, and two Russians were on board, and one American. The American is Shane Kimball. He's a ham radio operator. So, got another one up there. And he'll join the American, Kate Rubin, who's been up there for quite a few months now. And it'll be a 6-person crew for about 9-10 days or so. And then Kate Rubin's crew is scheduled to return at that time. So, they'll be back to 3 for a while. And she's coming back with her crewmates, Taka. Well, that's the name they call him, Taka, but it's really a long name. He'll be coming back, and the commander, of course, is Russian. They'll be flying back on their Soyuz spacecraft in about a week or two. So, that was pretty good. I know,
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout, cancel.
But I missed it between the trees. My life sword. But I missed it. My daughter had better luck, went out to the beach, and no problem. That's what you really need, a low horizon. Let me drop it. And that won't happen again until the end of December. I think it's December 30th. Now I've yet to find out if it's a daytime or nighttime launch. If it's dusk, you know, it should be good. You should be able to see it. Even if it's a little light out, but we'll try it next time around. And I'm glad to see it got off that launch that you talked about 2 years ago, blown up right after it left Wallops Island, and they were using engines, and now they've replaced them with these new RD-181s, which are more powerful, two engines. And then, of course, there's a third Castor 30XL. That's all. Also a new engine. That was for the second stage to continue bringing Cygnus to orbit. Now, Cygnus is a bigger cargo vehicle than last time, too. It was able to carry more mass. It's also more volume. It's a longer spacecraft, and they call it the enhanced version. It has different solar panels. It produces the same amount of solar power that the old solar panels had, even so the old ones were, you know, rectangular in shape. These are round. They're flex. They open up like a fan. There's two of them. But the difference is this is about 600 pounds lighter.
K6DTZ with a comment about meters. I just was able to get back here.
Okay, we'll take a 1 minute break from your space report, Paul, since Hal's available right now. Go ahead and tell us about how careful you got to be with the Dawson Bound movement so as not to get yourself in trouble. K6DTZ, KQIW.
Thank you, Dick. I just wanted to say there's a lot of times, a lot of meters you can find at a ham fest, and you don't know when you buy it, you know, if it may be good or bad. The only thing you have to do is take something, short out the back leads of the meter. First take the meter without shorting it, twist it in your hand back and forth. You'll see the movement, very free moving. Put a short on the two leads in the back of the meter, and if the movement is dampened, and it moves very slow, then you know the meter movement is okay. That's my only comment there. K2LIW in the testnet, K6DPC.
So the simple shorting alligator clip lead, so to speak, across the two screw leads on the back of a meter and swinging it that way and recognizing the damping function tells you it is electronically operative. The next step might be if you've got a compact volt-ohm milliammeter in your pocket, and you go to the times hundreds or times thousand scale, your ohm meter puts out a small amount of current. You again can connect those two leads to the meter, not because you're measuring current, but you're going to recognize the fact that the needle is going to move a specific amount, indicating how many microamps of response you've got. I bet you've done that on a few times, Hal, where you've used a simple VOM in order to see a meter movement to tell you that it's active. And you could actually calibrate the meter in that manner, I believe. K6DPZ, K2LIW.
K2LIW, K6DPZ. There's a lot more I could talk about meters. I don't want to cut into the space report, Dick. But the other thing I have to say, if somebody finds a bird watt meter at a ham fest, take a moment, turn it halfway where you're shorting out the 30 microamp meter and see if it dampens. If it dampens, the meter is good. If it doesn't dampen and the meter swings back and forth, that by the bird. It may have a back action or it could be an open meter movement. That's my only comments. Back to that. J6DPC.
And by that test, you find out that the meter in your bird Model 43 that's being offered for sale at a flea market, if you find out the meter movement is dead, which is rare but occasionally happens, you therefore can bid a hell of a lot less dollars. It's repairable, but it's a bit of a pain to replace that meter, is my guess. Back to you, Paul. WS2N, K2LIW, the Tech Man.
Okay, very good. Very good, Hal. The docking of the Cygnus spacecraft then took place today. And you had Kate Rubin in the cupola with her partner, right? This astronaut. There's always two of them doing this. And they reach out with the robotic arm. It's 57 feet long. And they grab a hold of it when it comes in range, about 30 feet away from the station. They can see out this cupola. It's a 360 degree view. They're looking down at Earth. And they grab it and attach it to the Unity node module. And they attach it to the Nadir, or the Earth-facing port. And that got bolted up, and then they hook up electrical lines and air lines. Now they're able to open the door and spend the next month or so unloading everything, and another month or so putting stuff onto that cargo vehicle, because that will eventually be burnt up over the Pacific. But before that happens, it'll spend a couple more weeks in space when it undocks from the space station, and it runs quite a few experiments before they actually burn that thing up. So that's the Cygnus spacecraft launched on the Antares rocket and safely attached to the space station. Now the crew that was sent up went on a Soyuz rocket and they docked to the Poisk module. That's one of the Russian docking modules, and that's all done automatically. They don't have a robotic arm reaching out and grabbing them. And, that's all done automatically. Similar to what we'll be doing once we get the American spacecraft, the two different ones, one by Boeing and one by SpaceX, up and running. They'll be able to dock automatically as well. So that's the story on that. The other topic I wanted to cover, I really didn't cover last week, was the potential landing of a spacecraft on Mars, which the European Space Agency was trying to do. They had a spacecraft that was supposed to land called Schiaparelli. Schiaparelli was a small spacecraft that didn't have solar panels, just batteries. Just a proof of concept for European Space Agency. They wanted to see if they could do it. And so they sent two Mars, two spacecraft, one called TRACE, and that's an orbiting spacecraft. We drop it. It was sent on the same rocket back in March, launched from Russia on a Proton rocket. And now, it just arrived. The TRACE spacecraft went successfully into orbit. And at the same time, Schiaparelli was supposed to land on Mars. It did pretty well. It started going through the EDL, the entry, descent, and landing phase. Didn't quite make the landing phase. Parachutes did open the heat shield separated from the bottom, and then the back shell that's attached to the parachute then separated, and this thing fell free fall. Drop it toward its landing site. The rockets came on. It had hydrazine rockets, 9 of them came on, but then shut off 3 or 4 seconds after they turn on. They were supposed to stay on a little bit longer. and it was about a mile up, and they shut down, and unfortunately too early. It was on, you know, it was supposed to shut down, you know, maybe a, you know, a few feet or so off the surface, and because it shut down a mile early, it wound up crashing into the planet at well over 100 miles per hour. So that was the end of that spacecraft. So unfortunately, they didn't make it, and they'll try again. They were supposed to launch again in 2 years with a rover. But about 6 months ago, they realized that they're behind schedule, underfunded. So they decided to delay that. It was supposed to go up in 2018. So now that will probably be going up in 2020. But they wanted this thing to succeed. This way they would have more information when they go to try to land their rover 4 years from now. Although the European Space Agency did say they got a lot of data back, and that they'll probably use that for information for landing. They planned on trying to do this. It would have lasted, I don't know, 48 hours or so, running out of batteries. But it didn't work out. So this is the second time they've tried this and lost the spacecraft, by the way. This happened again in 2003 with one of their spacecraft. Let me drop it. And the other topic I was just going to cover was the China crew that went up to the to their space station, the Chang'an 2 space station, successfully docked. I did see the clip of them opening the hatch door and going in and hooking up electrical connections, hooking up carbon dioxide scrubbers, and entering would be their second generation of spacecraft, space station. They got another one coming up in 2018. That'll be the first launch of, you know, occur at that time, and then it should take them about 4 or 5 years to assemble 4 or 5 modules attached to their space station. Let me drop it. And that's pretty much it for now, Dick. There's always other stories, other launches. They're the main ones for the week that has gone by. I know I've covered some topics in the past, but I guess there's no harm in reviewing some of them or parts of them, and we continue to do that as well. Back to you, Dick. If any questions, comments, K2RIW. This is WS2N for the space portion of the TechNet.
And what you're hearing is space report number 224, I believe. Now, so Trace and Schiaparelli. Trace is the one that went into orbit, and Schiaparelli, I think it is, was the lander that turned off its rockets too soon and crashed into the surface. The total number of spacecraft that have not succeeded in getting to Mars correctly, missing Mars, crashing into Mars, and whatever, I think it's a ridiculously large number of spacecraft over the last 30 or 40 years that didn't make it. I forget the number, but if you told me it's 25 spacecraft altogether, I'd sort of believe it. And had this one succeeded, the Schiaparelli, I think I read somewhere that it was going to dig some pretty deep holes in Mars and sample the soil very far down for water content, carbon dioxide, and living substances. Isn't that true, Paul? So roughly how many objects has planet Earth launched to Mars that were unsuccessful is question number one, and you might want to give us a couple of words on what Schiaparelli was likely to do has been successful. WS2N, K2LIW.
Not much, as far as I know. As far as Schiaparelli was supposed to just be a proof of concept, pretty much landing, and they had some science missions on board that was going to last a day or two. I know we have the InSight mission coming up in 2018, and that will be not a rover, but landing on Mars, and that will be drilling deep into the surface, up to 2 meters, to try to get some information out of the surface of Mars. This thing, I don't think it has.